Welcome and thank you for holding. At this time, your lines are in listen-only mode. A public comment period is scheduled to take place after the opening remarks. If you are interested in commenting on today's topic, you may press star one on your phone at any time to be placed into the queue. There is a limited time set aside for public comment, so please keep your comment to less than 1 minute. Stating your name and affiliation when prompted is optional. However, please provide us at least with an identifying alias. This will assist in administrating the session. You may also email comments to green.chemistry@dtsc.ca.gov. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I would like to turn the call over to Odette Madriago. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I hope you can hear me. I'll try and speak nice and loudly. I am Odette Madriago, Acting Chief Deputy Director for the Department of Toxic Substances Control, and I'm also the team leader for the group of folks working on these regulations. I'd like to start by saying good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are, and to thank you all for taking the time to participate in these subcommittee phone calls in preparation for our meeting in early May. The discussions that we all have today, as well as the follow-up call on April 13th, will provide valuable input for our May meeting, specifically on today's topic of chemical identification and prioritization. And our chair for these phone calls, Ken Geiser, will talk a little bit further about what we hope to get out of these phone calls. A little bit later in the agenda, I will briefly review with the members of the subcommittee the topic paper prepared for this phone call. And during today's call, I and several other members of DTSC staff are available to answer clarifying questions, provide any information you feel you need, and we will. We don't want to stifle ideas, and we mostly want today's discussion to be a discussion amongst the members of the subcommittee. But if I feel that we're going down tracks that are going well outside what we think are our legal boundaries or our resource boundaries, in other words, if I feel that the group is spending a lot of time talking about options that clearly don't fit within our statutory parameters or that are something that we don't think we can envision doing given our resource limitations, I'll just make a comment to that point. And finally, I'd like to apologize in advance. You know, doing this kind of meeting by phone call certainly has its challenges. And we want to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to ask their questions, voice their comments and opinions, and basically keep this on track. So there may be times when either Ken Geiser or myself may have to interrupt in the middle of somebody's talking. We will try to minimize that, but I do want to apologize if we find the need to do that. And so finally, a reminder again for those of you who may not have heard Kathy, we are having some volume issues, so I would ask that you speak up fairly loudly and close to your microphone or receiver, whatever mechanism you're using. So with that, I will turn it over to Kathy.
Okay, thank you so much, Odette. And I'm just going to do a very brief roll call, and this is a roll call of the Subcommittee 1 Green Ribbon Science Panel members. I'll start with Dr. Ken Geiser.
Here.
Dr. Julia Clint.
Here.
Dr. George Dastin.
Here.
Dr. Meg Schwartzman.
Here.
Dr. Julie Zimmerman.
Here. Here.
Dr. Art Fong.
Here.
Dr. Rich Malloy. I'm sorry, Rich Liroff.
Here. Here.
And Tim Malloy.
I'm here.
Thank you. By the way, Lauren Hine could not make it today, since her greetings to everybody. And then I'd like to just mention that we are going to be procuring a recording of this meeting, and it will be posted on our website when it's available, which should be within a day or two. Okay. And I'm going to turn it back over to Ken for an agenda review and introduction. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Kathy, and thank you, Odette. So today is a interesting experiment on our part to try out a new process for our subcommittee. This is for our panel. This is subcommittee number one. We're covering chemical identification and prioritization. This is the first of two meetings on this subject. The second meeting will take place on April 13th and roughly follow this same pattern. The purpose of this subcommittee is to provide an opportunity for a select group of panel members to engage in more detailed...
You're fading on us.
Am I? Okay, I'll try to be louder. To engage in more detailed and interactive discussion with Department of Toxic Substance Control staff prior to our reporting on these discussions at our full panel meeting on May 5 and 6 in Sacramento. The best way to think about this is that it is a kind of working session. We will be taking notes, and those notes will serve as the basis for our report to the full panel meeting. It is important to note that we are seeking to offer our advice and comment to the department staff as individual panel members, and we are not trying to reach consensus or agreement as a group. It is also important to recognize that this is a public meeting and that members of the public, as well as other panel members, may be listening in on our discussion. We will open time shortly for members of the public to share ideas. The department staff has put together a topic paper that includes three questions for this subcommittee. This topic paper, plus a set of attachments, has been sent to you in advance. Hopefully all of you have received this. If you did not receive these documents, please let us know now. Did everyone get them?
Yes.
Yes. Yep.
Good. You will find in the background documents relevant sections of AB 1879 and SB 509, as well as sections of AB 289, which is the State Health and Safety Code. This is followed by a list of authoritative government lists of chemicals with various hazard traits. Following this, there is a section on chemical prioritization hazard and exposure factor examples and prioritization factor examples. The fifth attachment includes the U.S. EPA's Design for Environment criteria for hazard assessment and conducting alternatives assessment. Attachment 6 presents Washington State's chemical prioritization scheme, while Attachment 7 presents a proposed hazard ranking formula. The last two attachments cover data quality issues. I hope that you've had a chance to review this material. To begin our discussion today, I want to focus our attention on the three questions the department staff has prepared. We are being asked to advise the department on how regulations can best be written to most effectively identify and prioritize chemicals of concern in the California economy. This chemical identification and prioritization provides the beginning of the process envisioned under AB 1879. It is important to interpret the law correctly while finding the most effective basis for meeting its intent. The first question asks if there should be one or two lists, with the second list identifying priorities in the first list. The second question asks about the criteria that should be used to place chemicals on the list or lists, and the third question asks if the generation of the list or list should be organized by specific chemicals or chemical groups, at least during the early implementation years. My suggestion is we begin with a broad discussion that addresses clarifications that you may need from the department to thoroughly address the questions. We will then take up each of the questions in sequence. I am hoping that today we will cover all three questions such that we consider our responses over the next week and dive even deeper on all three questions at our next meeting on April 13th. Hopefully this format works well for you. Any concerns about the format, just from any member of the panel or committee?
No.
Okay. Well, then why don't we begin the substantive part of this? We will begin with a brief review of the topic paper from Odette.
All right. Thank you, Ken. I hope you have the topic paper in front of you. The first page starts with a overview of some of the more pertinent sections of the statutes that authorize and mandate these regulations. Specifically, the statute calls on DTSC to adopt regulations to establish a process to identify and prioritize those chemicals or chemical ingredients in consumer products that may be considered as being a chemical of concern. The other bullet point reference portions of the statute to provide more guidance on how we're to go about doing that. And, of course, you have in your attachments a full set of the statute. I just want to emphasize that we want to keep in mind what the statute asks us to do and authorizes us to do. And so hopefully you've had a chance to refresh yourself on the statute itself. As Ken said, there are three questions that we would like you to discuss as a group and as individuals and provide us with your opinion and information. First question asks, should there be multiple chemicals lists? As you may recall, in the different iterations of the regulations last year, sometimes we had two chemicals lists. One was the initial larger list we called chemicals under consideration, or in some variations, chemicals of concern. And then there was a smaller list called priority chemicals or chemicals of concern, which were those chemicals that we then moved on to the next stage of the process in terms of identifying products for which alternative assessments would be required. So the question here is, should we, in moving forward, should we go with the one-list concept or the two-list concept? And it, assuming that we are going to do this as a two-list concept, should those lists be developed concurrently or sequentially? And part of that development is, you know, the department's own development, and then we put it out for public comment, either together or sequentially. So that's what we're asking you to think about and comment on with this question. And you may have some other thoughts that aren't captured in these options. The second question, which as you can tell by the number of sub-questions, is the most complex of the questions before you. Ask what criteria and process should be used to place chemicals on the list or lists. So the first question is, should one or both lists be a compilation of chemicals listed by other authoritative bodies? If so, which authoritative bodies? And to help you with your thinking and discussion on this, attachment 1-2 includes a list of authoritative bodies that some stakeholders have suggested that we use for this purpose. Next question. Should one or both lists be a compilation of all chemicals that exhibit one or more specified hazard traits? If so, should this be all of the hazard traits that OEHA ends up listing in their regulations, or should it be a subset thereof? And if so, which one? The next three sub-questions get to what factors should be used for prioritization. So question three is, what chemical hazard factors should be used to prioritize chemicals? Next question, should exposure potential factors also be used to prioritize chemicals? In both cases, which factors? If there are two chemical lists, what chemical hazard factors and what, if any, exposure potential factors should be used for each of the lists? The selection could be different for the two lists. And we've attached a couple of attachments, that's 1-3 and 1-4, that provide examples of both chemical hazard and exposure potential factors that could be considered. You will recognize, you know, a lot of these from various iterations of the regulations last year. These are just provided to you to provide food for thought. Question six, in assessing a chemical's threat of adverse impact associated with each identified prioritization factor, there are two questions. Should there be a threshold established for each factor? If so, how should those thresholds be determined? Should the prioritization evaluation be based on the chemical's individual threat of adverse impact, or should consideration be given to the chemical's contribution to cumulative or aggregate adverse impact? And how should this be evaluated? Question 7. Should one or both lists be developed using a ranking-type formula applied to the identified prioritization factors? And then there are a set of sub-bullets for this question. Now, attachments 1-5, 1-6, and 1-7 provide some examples or concepts for this kind of ranking approach. This is something that was suggested by several different stakeholders from different perspectives. So it's obviously an idea that's out there. I've also provided 1-6 is the DFE ranking system, and 1-7 is the Washington State ranking system. Now, both of these ranking systems are used for the chemical hazard assessment portion of an alternatives assessment. Nonetheless, I think they provide us with some, you know, a good starting point or a good model should we want to use this kind of approach for our chemical identification and prioritization process. So question 8 is, should one or both of the lists also include known bad actors? And there's some subset questions for this. This is out here because this is a suggestion that the department has heard from numerous sources during the course of our development of the regulations. Now, and so we're asking, is that a good idea? And if so, how would we go about identifying those? And finally, you know, this is a very complex question, and so there may be other ideas, other options that we have not captured in this listing here. The third and final question is, should the chemical list be limited to specified chemicals or chemical categories during early implementation years? Should there be a scope limitation or not? That's the fundamental question. The other two questions assume that there would be a scope limitation. So if there are two chemicals lists, should the scope limitation apply to one or both lists? And finally, what criteria should be used for the scope limitation? And several possible ideas are in the paper that you have before you. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Ken.
Thank you, Odette. As the subcommittee probably recollects, it is important for us to take public comment, and the public comments are again to us as a subcommittee. Comments we will open up here to the public. We're asking that comments be limited to 1 minute each, and we will go through each of the public locations to ascertain whether there are questions. At this point, I think I would turn this over to the operator to identify whether there are questions.
Yes, sir. At this time, if you would like to provide comments to the Green Ribbon Science Panel subcommittee members on today's topic, please press *1 and ensure your line is not muted. You will be prompted to record your name. Getting your name and affiliation is optional. However, providing at least an identifying alias will assist us in managing the session. Again, pressing *1 will enable you to join the queue and make a comment. If you wish to be removed from the queue, press *2. One moment while I wait for our first comment. Our first public comment comes from Dawn Kepke. Your line is open.
Good morning. This is Dawn Kepke on behalf of the Green Chemistry Alliance. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to provide some comments. Just some overall general comments regarding the Green Chemistry Alliance and its members from over 150 trade associations and individual companies based in California, as well as nationally and internationally. Relative to this particular discussion, we would just remind everyone that AB 1879, when it was passed, was predicated on state scientists deciding what chemicals would be identified as chemicals of concern. And that's really critical from our perspective in that we need to make sure that we're not cherry-picking lists and putting lists together based on what is the chemical du jour. That was the premise for the legislation to begin with, was getting away from that and really putting this in the hands of the scientists. For this reason, we really have come, as an alliance, to accept the use of authoritative bodies lists, in a situation that they be allowed to have notice for opportunity for comment prior to confirming chemicals of concern. In that way, all stakeholders are afforded the opportunity to provide data showing whether or not a chemical meets the scientific criteria and or volume and use criteria. Furthermore, it's conditioned on the opportunity to evaluate for use and potential exposure of intentional ingredients at or above de minimis levels in consumer products in making determinations about whether or not it represents a chemical of concern in that consumer product. Furthermore, we would just suggest that and want to ensure that this effort should focus on chemicals actually manufactured or imported into the U.S. and used in U.S. consumer products. We think that that's pretty important because a number of chemicals have been phased out and shouldn't be spending our time on things that are no longer actually used in consumer products.
If you could, to wrap up, please.
Sure. We are also adamant that the process avoid a defined list of chemicals and be based on scientific criteria and evaluations. GCA has recommended publicly that we start, and I want to emphasize start, with CMRs and PBT criteria as a starting point to get the program off the ground. We strongly oppose inclusion of neurotoxin endocrine disruptors at this point in the game, particularly because, as we understand it, there's no firm, scientifically vetted, and generally agreed-upon list. We also are wanting to ensure that per AB 1879's criteria that volume use and exposure information be used as part of the chemical priority screening, and I will leave it at that.
I'm not sure how many people we have wanting to make questions, but we need to...
We need to be sure.
...to give everybody equal opportunity.
Thank you. Operator, are there additional questions or
points? Yes, sir. We have one additional public comment. It comes from Philip Lowe. Your line is open.
Good morning. Philip Lowe, Sanitation District, Los Angeles County. This is also kind of my personal comments, too. I'm taking UC Berkeley class on green chemistry. I met all this regulatory structure and trying to get safer chemicals. The whole purpose of green chemistry is redesigned and to seek safer alternatives. So I just want to inject with the panel that besides all this hazard and regulatory structure, also focus on redesign and true alternatives that are safer. Thank you.
Thank you. Additional questions?
We're showing no further comments at this time.
Let me just check with all of the different public sites, the Berkeley site and others. Are there any additional comments from members of the public at those sites? Hearing none, I guess that would close our public comment period. Thank you very much, operator. So, now the ball shifts back to our subcommittee.
In view of the fact that we have no other public comments and we are way ahead of concluding this part of the agenda, we could let Dawn briefly finish off her comments, if you'd like.
Once again, press star 1 if you'd like to rejoin the queue.
Okay. Guess not.
Thank you, Odette. Does that finish us up with the public comments?
It did take a minute for her to record her name. Would you like to go ahead and open up the line for Dawn?
Yes.
Okay. Your line is open.
Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate the additional time. Definitely. It's hard to get through everything you want to say in such a short time.
Sure.
Nevertheless, just wanted to follow up just relative to the process pieces of it that we really want to ensure that the process of prioritizing chemicals of concern be based on national volume data, national emissions data, and generalized data about the nature and kinds of uses for the chemicals. These were concepts that the Green Chemistry Alliance has been talking about for the last 2 years, and we think that volume and use data combined with hazard data can inform the prioritization process. it's from our perspective, it's not necessary to have data on the precise product used, the precise number of products sold, the precise manner in which those products are used, and by whom to develop the workable prioritization process. And this is something that we've had lengthy discussions with the department about, but we think looking to systems such as HPV, IUR for, you know, those volume and some of those data pieces, particularly with additional information coming into those systems soon and in the coming years, we think that that could be incredibly helpful. And although it's not California-specific, it does start to provide some basis for prioritizing and understanding, you know, what is most prevalent in commerce. And so we really would urge that those be considerations going forward. So that's all I have prepared at this point, but I look forward to the dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Any additional comments?
I'm still showing no other comments in queue.
All right. Okay. All right. So at this point, we will turn then to the substantive part of the actual discussion. And my suggestion is that we have maybe 10 minutes of just open questions to Odette on clarification or any general comments that you have about the three questions that we have before us, and then we will move into trying to take them up sequentially. But let's just start with an open discussion, any member of the committee. My recommendation on these phone calls, it's always a bit awkward. Could you just state your name quite loudly, and I will keep a tally of people who have stated their names as an indication that they wish to speak. So, let us begin.
Art Fong?
Go ahead, Art.
Good morning. Thanks very much, Chair. I have a question for Odette. Is it important at this point for the Green Ribbon Science Panel to get a perspective or overview of what is stated on attachment 1-3, page 2 of 2, what it talks about, you know, the list and the final outcome and how that is limited in the number based on the availability of DTSC resources to evaluate consumer products containing these chemicals. So I take that to mean that, in fact, that will very much have an influence on the three questions on, you know, the process and the final outcome. Odette, is it important at this point for us to get from DTSC a perspective or overview of what resources are, in fact, available? And if you guys, in fact, have a, you know, number in mind in terms of ideally what the number of chemicals would be that you can handle once we start getting these chemicals on the list. Again, I think that would may influence how we, you know, view and approach the three specific questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Art. Those are good questions. I do not have precise answers for you. What I can tell you in terms of the number of resources, that is, you know, a question that's part of the budget process, so I don't have an answer. But I can tell you, as you know, California, like many other states in the nation, have significant budget problems. So at this point in time, the assumption we are making is that we will have to staff this largely, if not totally, by redirections from other programs. So that will, of course, limit how many staff resources we can put on this effort. Now, in terms of, and so what you're right, I do want the panel, both the subcommittees and the panel, to be mindful of that so that as you're making recommendations, be thinking about where it is that, from your perspective, you think the department's limited resources can best be spending their time. Now, in terms of the number of chemicals, I don't have, you know, a magic number. I think certainly if you go, you know, if we go with the approach of two lists, I think the first larger list, chemicals under consideration, or whatever we end up calling them, that can be fairly large and robust. It's that smaller list or the single list, if we go with the single list approach, that has to be kept small, because those are the chemicals for which we then have to expend resources, identify products containing those chemicals, and then go through the alternatives assessment process. So I don't have a magic number for you. I can just tell you that it needs to be small. And it's not just because we have resource limitations, so that is the number one factor. But when we start out this program, you know, it's going to be new for all of us, and it's going to be sort of a piloting phase. And so until we really get our feet wet, and I'm using the collective R, not just us, but all the stakeholders, you know, I think it's wise to start out relatively small until we get this fully developed and work out the kinks. So I don't have definitive numbers, but that's what I can tell you.
Thank you, Odette. Art, do you want to follow up, or is there anyone else who wants to ask some general questions?
Tim Malloy for a general question.
Tim, go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask regarding question 1A about whether there should be multiple lists or not. I'm wondering, Odette, if you could lay out for us what at least the current thinking is in terms of the pros and cons of having one list versus two.
Well,
I mean, it's good to ask Odette that. It's also good for us to try to deal with that.
Yeah.
I agree, but I just wanted to know, I mean, I think it would be, at least for me, to kind of respond to a question like that, it's helpful to know kind of where the thinking has come from and where it currently is.
Okay. Pros and cons. I mean, there are certainly, you know, and we've heard pros and cons from a number of stakeholders, particularly in the last version of the regulations where we went to one list. I think that really brought this issue to the forefront. Obviously, you know, the advantage of having a single list is it's less resource intensive. That is, I would say, the biggest pro of having a single list. In terms of having two lists, more resources are involved. But there are a number of stakeholders, again, stakeholders from varying perspectives, who seem to like having the two lists because they viewed the larger list as putting people on notice. And when I say people, I mean the public, as well as manufacturers and other stakeholders, in terms of what chemicals may be up for further consideration down the road. So I think those are, from my perspective, the main considerations. But as Ken says, this is something we'd like to hear from you on.
Thank you.
Julia Quint.
Julia, please.
I have a question about when we talk about a small number of chemicals or list one or two, does that mean that written into the regulation, I guess I'm confused as to if we have this in the regulation, whether or not it would limit us down the road to considering a larger number of chemicals. Because basically, science isn't going to stop after the regulation is written. And so I think that in thinking about this, it's important for me to know whether or not our discussion today about one or two lists and how many chemicals and that sort of thing, whether or not that's going to pose a regulatory limitation on chemicals of concern down the road.
Okay. I don't think we are necessarily envisioning putting a number limit into the regulation. It's just something, a reality to be aware of. And certainly, you know, it is our goal and our aim in writing these regulations to come up with, you know, something that is flexible, as clear as possible, and yet as flexible as possible going forward, so we can make these adjustments, hopefully without having to go back through the regulatory process.
Right. I just want to add to that, because the hazard traits are important because they capture toxicological information that probably isn't currently, don't reflect chemicals that are already listed. In other words, you know, there are some groups of chemicals for which lists don't exist. So I think it also is important to realize that the more chemicals will be listed based on some of the hazard traits down the road. Thank you.
Additional general comments or clarifications?
George Daston.
George.
Thanks, Ken. So I want to make sure that I'm clear in my mind. The way that, you're thinking about the possibility of two lists, Odette, is that the first list of chemicals of concern would be, say, based on some hazard trait that we define together. So CMRs, for example, or PBTs might be among the chemicals of concern. And then the priority chemicals list is really just a pragmatic selection of those as to how much the department can handle?
Not necessarily. I mean, there are different options for how we identify what's going to be on the larger list and then how we pare that down. So, for example, the larger list could be, again, a list of lists, and or it could be developed by looking at different prioritization factors. But then the smaller list that we actually move forward through the process, I think, to be, in my view, to be in keeping with the statute, we wouldn't just be using our resources to come up with that smaller list. Coming up with that smaller list, I think, will also need to be a prioritization process that takes into consideration whatever chemical hazard and if we do add them, exposure potential factors that we eventually agree upon within the department.
Okay, but then there would be a third process. So, in the event that hundreds of chemicals ended up being on that priority chemicals list, there would have to be a third process of pragmatic prioritization. Am I getting that right?
Possibly, but I at least the way we had envisioned it so far, though, you know, there could be a different way of doing it, is that when we come up with that final list, that in the process of doing, I mean, the way it was laid out in the last version of the regulations, and I think it is described in this attachment, is we would first prioritize using such factors as chemical hazards and exposure potential to come up with the first cut, and then we would apply some additional factors, one being the availability of resources.
Okay.
So I don't think that we would necessarily have like three lists, but that was sort of our thinking and how we might go about it.
I understand.
Rich Leroff, a clarification question.
Richard.
Please remind me, does the statute provide for an updating of the list every X number of years? Or is that provided for just in the draft regulations that were developed last year? Depending on your answer, I have a follow-up question.
Okay. The statute is silent on that, but that has always been our concept that these would be living iterative lists and would continue to be updated on, you know, a periodic basis.
The reason I asked, thank you very much for that, the reason I asked is kind of a follow-up to Julia Quinn's comment. On the one hand, we're all tired, or many people are tired, of the chemical of the day or the chemical of the month syndrome. On the other hand, as Julia pointed out, new scientific findings do surface from time to time. And I just find myself wondering, well, what if dramatic new information surfaces about a particular chemical, does one update the priority list, however it is ultimately decided to be developed? Does one act on that chemical using other regulatory authority independent of the Green Chemistry Program? Why?
Is that a question you want me to try to answer?
Yeah, I'm curious what the answer is.
Okay. Well, we had envisioned that, and again, this is why we're trying to keep the regulations as flexible as possible, that were such a new chemical or new information on a chemical come to light that was so critical that we could go through the process of updating the list to add that chemical. In terms of managing the chemical under some other regulatory scheme, I'm not sure what you're specifically referring to there, unless you're talking about somebody, you know, introducing a bill in our legislature to do that. You know, other than the fact that we do have the AB 289 call-in authority. Yeah, Jeff has something to add. That's Jeff Wong.
So this is Jeff Wong. So Richard, if I can kind of understand and read between the lines your question, you're concerned that if we rely upon one pathway, which is base our listings under our regulation based upon the presence of that chemical on another list, that is too rigid of an infrastructure, so would it not allow us to incorporate new scientific data and new scientific or endpoints of concern? If we choose another path, which is hazard or endpoint based, then we would then be allowed to add some new endpoint that we might discover in the future. Am I seeing that concern?
That could be one version, Jeff. I guess what I'm getting at, I just want to make sure that whatever process is established, and you know, we don't have to get into the question of what other authorities are out there. I don't want to take us, you know, down a side route or even into a dead end. I just want to make sure that whatever process is established here doesn't tie the state's hands in terms of its ability to respond to emerging science that's critical in nature about the hazards from a particular chemical in consumer products. That's all I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, I would reiterate what Odette has previously said, in that we are trying to, again, develop a transparent process, but also a process that has some predictability, but also a process that is flexible and can incorporate new science.
I'm fine. Thanks very much.
Any other general comments? Well, let's then move into these. The hope here, as I said at the top here, is that we could go through all of three of questions. There's the first one, obviously, is a big policy question, and the others follow from that, and try to get through them all today with the idea that if we don't say everything we have to say on them, we will come back to this on our April 13th meeting. So with the permission of the committee, I would suggest we focus on the subject we've already begun to dig into a bit here, which is, what does the committee think of one or two lists? How would you provide advice to the department on this? And if there are two lists, how should they relate to each other?
Ken, are we supposed to put our names in a T? This is Meg. I mean, in a Q?
Yes, please do. And for those of you who are being so careful to wait for the pauses, you can also just yell out your name at a certain point if you think you want to get into the queue. So Meg would be next.
Julie, I'd like to be in the queue.
Okay, Julie.
George,
yep. I have Meg, Julia, and George. Meg, go ahead.
Just to start off with, my recommendation is that there be two lists, that they be developed concurrently, that the shorter list be a subset of a larger list, so this is just the broadest outlines of my recommendations, but to put them all out on the table, that there be something that's already been mentioned, the schedule for updates, and also a process for, that is two kinds of updates. One is new nominations to the list, and the other is bringing the DTSC's list in line with changes in source lists.
Julia, you want to add to this?
Yes, Julia. Meg said most of what I wanted to say. I agree with her points. I just want to emphasize again that the hazard traits require some, and I think we'll talk about the hazard traits and how they, you know, will relate to the list. But in, I guess I'm concerned that one of the factors that we consider in terms of when developing these lists is to look through those hazard traits and to make sure that important endpoints like neurodevelopmental toxicity and those sorts of things, which don't currently exist on any list, that they be, you know, given the consideration that they deserve, given that, you know, the sensitive populations of developing fetuses and things like that, this would be a very, very important endpoint for them. So we haven't talked about how we set the priorities. I do think that the larger list will be sort of give notice for people to plan about what's coming up, because after all, this is to be the end point here is safer alternatives. So the larger list is really very, very important, but it is also important to prioritize. So anyway.
Sort of two goals there that I hear you saying.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. George.
I'm not sure that I can answer this question of one or two lists until we've really come to some sort of recommendation on what the list should contain. And because of that, I'm a little concerned about having two lists. I'd rather have one list. I mean, I can easily see how we could all agree that if a universally viewed authoritative body had developed some clear criteria as to, you know, why something was a chemical of concern, that it would be already on this priority chemicals list. I also, you know, very much take the points that have been made, that Julia made and others have made already, that, you know, there are going to be limits to the number of chemicals that have been evaluated and also to the number of endpoints that have been evaluated with the intent of making those kinds of lists. And I think really, you know, that's why the statute says that a process be developed rather than a list be developed. So it almost seems to me that, you know, the list part is at least initially going to be derivative of authoritative bodies, and I don't see that any reason why one would need more than one list, in that, you know, a carcinogen is a carcinogen and a mutagen is a mutagen, for example. So I don't see why we would want to put one on one list and one on another. But for those others where we really don't have authoritative body lists because authoritative bodies don't have processes necessarily laid out for creating such lists, that we would want to have more of a process and not a second list, not this chemicals of consideration or chemicals of concern list.
George, can I ask, you suggested something just a little while earlier where you talked about a third process or something. Would I get a picture from what you're talking about is maybe there's one list and then there would be a process by which the department would sample priorities from that? Is that, and could you say a little bit about what that process would look like if you could?
Well, what I meant to say was, you know, there would be one list that could be derived from authoritative bodies, and as we all know, those are going to be limited in terms of the endpoints that they cover. And I think that everybody is really clear that we'd like to cover more than what is just on, say, CMR or PBT lists. But then the problem arises as, you know, what really constitutes a neurotoxicant or, you know, a liver toxicant or whatever might be on the long list of hazard traits. And I think that that's a lot more difficult, and I'm not sure that we could put together a clear list of chemicals that would fit in there. That's what I'm talking about as a process for defining a larger list of chemicals based on additional hazard traits.
is Meg. Can I jump in when there's a chance?
Meg.
And this is Rich. I'd like to
just check on others. Meg, anyone else?
Yeah, Rich would like to be on the queue, please.
Meg, Rich, anyone else?
And this, let me just jump in real quickly. Okay. I guess I should have said in the beginning that periodically, well, I think I did say I would jump in when I saw things going in a direction that we might
not. You're more than welcome to jump in.
So all I wanted to say in response to what George was saying is, if I heard you correctly, George, you were contemplating that we might have one list that would include all chemicals on some subset of other authoritative bodies list, and then we might add a few others on through a process. So the only caution I want to offer is that would sound to me like, because we're looking at everything on other authoritative bodies list, that's going to be too big a list. So we would have to have two lists. We'd have to winnow down to some smaller subset for us to be able to manage. So that was all I wanted to clarify there.
Understood.
Meg?
Yeah, I realized that we didn't back up for a moment just to be clear that we all mean the same thing by lists and what these two lists are. And in my mind, the way that I'm thinking of them is, I don't suggest we change the terminology, but the way I'm thinking of them is buckets. I don't think we should change the words in the regulations, but it's more like I don't think anyone wants to write a list into the regulation. The point is to create criteria, right? And that's question 1B. So we're not talking yet about exactly what the criteria are. This is more like designing the buckets, is question 1A as I understand it. So in my mind, there's one very, very large bucket that, and the criteria around that fleshed out further, but that is, you know, like what the department initially proposed as the chemicals under consideration. It's the larger, more comprehensive list. And then what's defined in the regulation is a process of selecting chemicals from that large bucket and putting them into the smaller bucket, which is the chemicals that are being acted on currently in any given sort of cycle of the regulatory implementation. And since the other processes of the other steps in the regulation, the subsequent steps that flow from identifying chemicals of concern, those hinge on there being a defined universe of those chemicals that need to be acted on right away. And so I think, so just to be clear that when we're talking about two lists, that's what I'm picturing, and I don't know if other people are picturing different things or we might be talking past each other, but that second list would be this smaller bucket that, given you know, cycle between scheduled updates, is a static number of chemicals in that, and we don't name the number, but it's a static collection of chemicals in that smaller bucket, as it were, that then, you know, companies are required to identify the products that contain those chemicals, and it's a limited universe, but there is room for there to be a much larger universe that is, like many people have been saying, providing some view of what's to come. So that's what I was picturing by the two lists. It's more like two categories, and the smaller one is a subset of the larger one, and there's nothing on the smaller one that isn't in the larger one. I'd be interested to hear if anyone was picturing something different than that.
Right. Rich, go ahead.
I just wanted to second George's point. I guess I'd feel more comfortable moving more immediately to 1B on criteria and process, and then swing back around to the one versus two lists questions.
I'm happy to do that, but I just want to make sure if anybody else has comments on this. We've had at least two different ideas on this, and George's recommendation that we go further and come back to this question. Anyone else want to make comment on this first question?
This is Julia. I think it's both maybe a question. The larger list, which, you know, I see as a large list based on authoritative bodies and other things that we might consider, what I consider sort of the you know, the big bucket and Meg's lingo. But then having to, I mean, one thing that's really important is to prioritize. Those lists, as Odette or somebody else mentioned, that's going to generate a large number of chemicals. So of that larger sort of planning, big bucket list, somebody, and hopefully with help from us, to prioritize that list. But then there, you know, we haven't, part of this is going to be driven by whether or not the chemicals that are important toxicologically and environmentally are also in products that, you know, people are using. So some of this is, you know, I know there's another subcommittee dealing with products. But then a third list might be from the things that are toxicologically important and from the authoritative bodies list. You know, do they make it to a list that we want to whittle down even further because there are many products that a lot of sensitive populations might be using that contain, you know, some of these chemicals but not others. So it's a little murky at the moment because I think the larger list has to be prioritized and then it's going to be further prioritized based on, because we're dealing with products. We're not dealing with just chemicals here. We're dealing with chemicals that are in products that we're concerned about. So I see it as a kind of a, not written into the regulation, but it's a kind of a three list sort of thinking process as far as I'm concerned. They're muddled.
Others who haven't had a chance to speak want to try to get into this? Tim or anyone else?
Ken, this is Kathy, and I actually have one thing that I want to bring up before you move on. So I'll wait until other people have a chance to talk.
Okay. Let me just see if anybody wants to make a comment on this first question, although please understand we're going to kind of go into the second question and come back to this one.
This is Tim, if I could say just a word or two.
Please.
I guess I'll muddy it up just a little bit more because as I think of it, I want to follow up on Julia's point that this whole process, at least according to the statute, is designed to come up with to identify and prioritize chemicals in consumer products. And I wonder if, you know, the idea of creating so many lists and buckets, while those I think are useful ways of generating kind of action items, I'm wondering whether it's making, creating too many steps. Because to me it seems like the question is not whether one particular chemical is worse kind of in theory or, you know, just toxicologically or in terms of its inherent or intrinsic hazard, but rather when you combine it with the notion of what products it's in. So I wonder if it's not too early to be creating separate lists of chemicals and then prioritizing those chemicals and whether that should not be more of an integrated approach that takes first identifies chemicals, then looks at product uses, and then the prioritization takes place at that point. So I guess where that comes for me is I'm not sure I, at this point, see the usefulness of two separate chemical lists here, because it would strike me that one could imagine that a chemical, just looking at it intrinsically, you might say, well, this is of much less importance to us than, say, these other 20 chemicals or whatever. But when you look at its particular use, suddenly that chemical in that use may jump ahead of all of those. And by kind of this reductionist approach of taking a set of chemicals and then slicing it down into a set of prioritized chemicals that then get in some way reviewed with respect to their use, I worry that maybe the prioritization can get askew. Maybe I'm just not understanding what's happening in the other group, and this is something that's already being thought of. But that's one concern I have about having separate, creating all these separate lists and buckets this early in the process.
Just so that if I could just say something there, there are probably different ways you could approach that, but certainly, and this really does get to question two, 1B. When we're talking about the criteria. But, you know, one of the types of criteria that could be used to come up with that smaller list, and this would be the exposure-related criteria, would be what types of products the chemical is present in and how and who uses that product. So I just want to point that out.
Can I follow up on Tim's point?
Yes.
I think what I was picturing is that a second list is the result of prioritization through whatever criteria wind up being decided on for prioritization, and that's not what this moment is for. But I'm curious, Tim, to know, I'm totally open to the idea, to other options that I haven't pictured, and so I want to know what your picture is of, if you don't start from a large set of criteria, set priorities in order to create a second smaller list that the department starts from, that's like, here's the first round, what were you picturing instead?
In terms of
how would the department proceed after creating the very large list that everybody's talking about, that's all inclusive, goes beyond CMRs, et cetera? What happens next in your mind if we're not creating a second smaller sublist that's the first target?
Well, I guess this is, in a way, this is the concern I have about, there's an inherent assumption built into your question, which is it's going to start out with a very large, big list, and then there'll be a necessity to kind of winnow that down in this kind of bucket approach, which I think is a very elegant approach. And, I'm not trying to suggest that I don't think that's the way to go. This is more me trying to think through what are the underlying assumptions we're starting with. So it takes me back, I think, initially to George's first point, which is, I think it was George who made the point that you'd really want to know what are the criteria that are going to be used for creating this, what everyone, I guess, is assuming is going to be this very large first list, right? Because what I take from your point, Meg, is that you're going to have such a large list that it's not going to be tractable in terms of being able to then take your initial list of what, I don't know what you would call, of chemicals of concern unpaired with product use or whatever, that maybe that'll be so large that it's not practicable to prioritize the chemicals with taking into account actual product use, right? So you've got to winnow that down and find the ones that you're most worried about in terms of hazard. I perfectly understand that, but I think that's driven by really this question 1B about just how big will that list be and how what does that do in terms of tractability of doing later prioritization, which takes into account product use. In a sense, I take Odette's point, and I think that's a fair one, and that's where I'm struggling with this question, because if one of the things that you use for developing your list of hazardous chemicals that you're going to take on is what their product use is, then what will happen, what's the difference of the extent of the next prioritization piece, which is when you look at the chemicals actually in consumer uses. So is that mean you do that twice? Is it integrated? So for example, if the product use is integrated into the formation of a list of chemicals of concern, that's different to me than the way at least our subgroups are set up, where it seems like the first step is going to be identifying the hazardous chemicals, the second step is going to be prioritizing them based on use. So that's where my puzzlement comes up, and I don't suggest I have like the right answer to that.
But thanks, Tim. That's helpful. I understand what you're getting at of just calling out what are the underlying assumptions that we're making, and now I'm on the same page with feeling like we need to answer question 1B before we can answer question 1A.
Let me just check to see if there's anything left on 1A. Anyone who hasn't spoken on 1A? No. Okay. So it looks like we've covered 1A with a certain... We've had a sense that there is a list and possibly two.
This is Kathy.
A different...
I wanted to bring something up.
Who is this?
Kathy.
Oh, Kathy, yes, that's right. I was just...
Before we went forward, and I just wanted to correct an oversight on my part with respect to the public comment period.
Yeah.
Dr. Paul DeLeo had submitted comments. He's from the American Cleaning Institute. And I just wanted to let people know I sent those comments to the Green Ribbon Science panel yesterday, and they will be posted on the web this afternoon. The reason I bring this up now is that the comments were relevant to this particular question. So I just wanted to call people's attention to that, make sure that everybody knows that those were submitted. And to make it a very short summary, his recommendation was to focus on process issues, in particular, what is a scientifically defensible process for identifying and prioritizing chemicals of concern in consumer products. And that's as far as I'll go with that. Just wanted to call your attention to those comments, with my apologies. Okay.
Thank you, Kathy.
I have a process question.
Pardon?
I have a process question.
Who is this?
Meg Schwartzman, sorry.
Oh, Meg. Yes, please.
I just want to know if I don't have the agenda right up in front of me. Is there going to be a five-minute break at some point?
We hadn't planned on one. What I think I might do, if you are asking for that, why don't we wait another, say, 15 minutes and check in on that?
Yeah, at 11 or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Thank you.
Great.
Okay.
Let's move to it sounds like some people feel like it's useful that their answer to question 1A is moved along by consideration of 1B. So if we could move to 1B at this point. Again, we haven't solved all the questions on 1A. But 1B is a long question with several, five or six different subgroups to it. But it's really asking us, how would you construct either one or two lists? Could we focus on that?
This is Rich. I'd like in the queue.
Okay, who else?
Julia.
Rich, Julia.
Greg.
Okay, Rich.
I'd like to throw out a starting point suggestion, recognizing that it does have some limitations. We indeed have nine small Roman questions in front of us with subsets of bullets. I want to drop down to number four. Should exposure potential factors also be used to prioritize chemicals? If so, what factors? What I'd like to throw out is a suggestion that, and this plays to the need to be careful how big a list we create. I'd like to suggest that perhaps one starting point for setting priorities would be actual data, actual biomonitoring data, because it takes us from the world of exposure potential to exposure reality. We know chemicals have been measured. Now, they've been measured in various compartments. Some have been measured in amniotic fluid, others in cord blood, others in mother's milk, mother's blood. One could, hypothetically, especially overweight chemicals that have been found in amniotic fluid. We know they're there. We know that there is an especially vulnerable living organism there. Now, what might be the limitations of such an approach? One is that it's human health biased, and if one wants these lists to include consideration of environmental factors, then you know, this is clearly a human health bias. Okay? One could have that. One does have to set priorities. The second is I am not a scientist, my customary disclaimer. So I really don't know what the N is, what the numbers of chemicals are that, say, amniotic fluid has been assessed for. Same thing with cord blood. I don't know whether we're looking at 10 chemicals or 30 chemicals or 100 chemicals. Maybe the list is too constrained. I'm not sure. I would also want to suggest that moving from exposure to what the hazard criteria of concern are, separate issue, but I think also important, is that one of the ranking formula examples that was given to us just for illustrative purposes suggest toxicity times potential for exposure times persistence plus bioaccumulation. I have a concern about the emphasis on persistence and bioaccumulation. You know, everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, but many folks point to PBTs as a useful starting point. But what about those chemicals which may not be persistent and bioaccumulative, yet you have the functional equivalent of persistence so far as there is continual exposure to them on a fairly daily basis? The scientists on the panel can correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that bisphenol A is not persistent and bioaccumulative, yet there is very real concern about chronic exposure to it and possible health effects that flow from that. Getting back to my point about biomonitoring, about chemicals that have been biomonitored, and then I'll stop, it seems to me that, okay, once you are building from presence or absence in biomonitoring study, then there you can kick in whatever, you can add in whatever hazard factors you want to add in so as to set priorities among those monitored chemicals. That's the end of my suggestion.
This is Odette. Let me jump in really quick. Rich, in response to your question about how many chemicals we have data for, I don't recall what the number is, but I can tell you that this is something the department looked at early on, and it was our opinion, at least at that time, that it was a relatively limited list. So I don't know that it would, you know, if we looked at the list, that the panel would consider that it was broad enough to use that as a limiting factor as opposed to something that you start with and then add on to.
Thank you.
Okay. Julia would be next.
Yes, I want to comment on the biomonitoring aspect. I think, you know, exposure, biomonitoring is the biomonitoring data are a good place to start with exposure. I think you can easily sort of cross that with hazard potential as well, because some biomonitoring data is just because, you know, it's based on the prevalence of the chemical in the environment and in products, and so the toxicological part of that hasn't been worked out so well. But for a number of them, I think there are robust toxicological data, especially being and a lot of that is being vetted in the biomonitoring science guidance panel in the state. So I think it would be good to marry those two processes as much as possible. I think the list should, I guess in developing a list of chemicals, the authoritative bodies is attractive because the science has been vetted in most cases. Has also gone through a public process so that we have public input. But I think it's very important to choose chemicals from lists or have authoritative bodies where there's been a robust sort of, you know, evaluation of the data. There are many lists out there, and I've looked at a lot of them, and not all lists are developed equally. So I think it's very important to just make sure that whatever list we're taking the chemicals from and identifying as authoritative bodies. And I think the ones that we identified early on are good lists, the NTP list, IARC list, NTP, CER, HR list. Those lists, you know, come, whatever is on those lists and the EPA list, to the extent that if there's an IARC document, the science has been well vetted, and I think that's going to be very important. Also, some of these lists, you know, they're not all separate chemicals. The IARC list and the NTP list and the Prop 65 list have many of the same chemicals on them. So you narrow the universe a lot. And in the Prop 65 list, some of the chemicals are both carcinogens and reproductive and developmental toxicants. So, you know, one chemical can be have more than one health endpoint as the basis for which it's listed. So I think a compilation, we should see where we are when we take the list that we identified early on and see, you know, how many chemicals we're really talking about. because I think there is, as I said, considerable overlap. So anyway, I'll stop there. And again, the hazard traits, I guess we're going to do this in order, one and then small two and three. Is that right, Ken?
No, I'm thinking that this is an open thing on
all. Oh, okay. All right.
So
well, I'll give somebody else a chance, but I do want to say something about the hazard traits.
Yes. Go ahead, please. Do you want to go ahead, Julie?
Oh, go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah, I think the hazard trait list, you know, again, the hazard traits are going to capture endpoints of concern that the authoritative body lists don't capture. So if we have to choose between hazard traits, for instance, there is no list of asthmogens because we don't have animal data and we don't develop those lists. Some countries do, but we don't, and they're all over the map. So I think the hazard trait as it relates to respiratory sensitization, skin sensitization, we don't have lists for those. If we have to prioritize among the hazard traits, I think they should capture toxicological or health endpoints that are really of high concern that we can't get from any of the lists that we've identified so far. I think that would be really important. And I mentioned neurodevelopmental. I mean, I think hugely important, and we aren't, you know, there may be lists that I'm not familiar with them, but I think, again, the point should be is to augment, go beyond the carcinogens. There will be many more carcinogens, for instance, on all of these lists than there will be reproductive toxicants because we haven't had a group like the NTP-CERHR hasn't been around very long. So there are very few chemicals that have gone through that process. So, again, hazard traits are going to be important for developmental and reproductive toxicity because we don't have a large number, you know, we don't have good lists for those. Okay, that's it.
Thank you. I think Meg, you're next.
Thanks. So one comment about following up on what Rich and Julie have both said about biomonitoring data. I agree that biomonitoring data is critical, it's an excellent resource, and it should really only be used as the exposure screen, like Julia said, and from that you can select hazard, but we should make sure not to misconstrue biomonitoring as equaling hazard, and it's an excellent resource for exposure, identifying exposure. Potential or in this case actual exposure, and we should use it. In terms of the number, you know, it depends, of course, on there's overlap, and it depends on how you count. Certainly the CDC has identified 212, but there's a lot of, if you winnowed that down, there are different, like, for example, PCBs and PBDEs, there's many different congeners and PAHs and things like that. And there are also substances that do not fall under the purview of this regulation, like many pesticides and drugs, medications, and things like that. So it's probably actually when you look at, if you were to lump PCBs or lump PBDEs, it's probably a much smaller number, like, you know, tens, so under 100, certainly. But that we should really be understanding those as exposure. I would add a couple things about, one other large category. I think that there should be a way of including on a list, and I think our thinking will be refined about what list this is, and I'm not sure what the answer is now, but I feel like it's essential that we have a mechanism for identifying data-poor substances that are in use. So a classic example of this right now that's very active is bisphenol S, BPS. So we know, and it's coming out more and more, that many products that are claimed BPA-free are, of course, BPA-free, but they have BPS in them. And there's very little about BPS. It doesn't take a large feat of imagination to assume that there are going to be some similar findings in terms of the behavior of BPS and BPA, not to say they won't be distinguishable, but so there should be some way that we're identifying data-poor substances, and we can talk more about refining the idea of how to include those. capture those within at least our eyesight, you know, that they be on the radar. And finally, on the question of hazard traits, working, so there's two aspects to hazard traits. One is hazard traits of chemicals identified by authoritative bodies, and the other is hazard traits for which there are not excellent lists or well-developed lists. And with regard to the authoritative bodies, a resource that some of you know exists, but maybe not all, is the database that we're developing here at Berkeley called PLUM. And I could send around a list of the authoritative body lists that we've already incorporated into it. A beta version will be available in June. And it does have some of the other sources of lists on it are include like European Union risk phrases that include substances such as there are risk phrases that look at impairing fertility, and so those may not be on the NTP-CERHR list. So there are other resources like that, including an asthmogen list that, you know, we should look at to see how comprehensive we think it is, but some other resources like that we're compiling in PLUM. And finally, I guess I would just second Julia's point about identifying those hazard traits that are very poorly captured by authoritative body lists, such as neurodevelopmental harm and, you know, whether we're getting respiratory sensitization adequately. I'll end there.
George, you felt like it was important.
Ken, this is Rich. Just a quick clarification. If people thought I was equating exposure with hazard, I was not. And the biomonitoring data are exposure data, and then indeed you've got to figure out whether or not there are traits that make those hazardous exposures. Just to clarify, thank you.
Right. Thank you, George. You felt like it was important to talk in this area in order to address the first question. Do you want to sort of explore that here?
Yeah, please. Thanks for that. So I guess I wanted to start, jump off something that Julia said, which is there are lists and there are lists. And I think that's exactly right. And the reason that there are lists and there are lists is that all lists are created with different processes. And I think as we've gone through and evaluated things for their quality, as Julia says, you know, we pick the ones where the evaluation processes have been especially robust. So, you know, IRIS that everybody looks at as a gold standard, or the European Union's CMR lists, for example. And I think that those are the kinds of things that I'm hoping we can get universal agreement ought to be the nucleus of any sort of priority list for this particular process. One could add Prop 65's process as well, even though it's kind of a secondary thing and that a lot of it is based on authoritative body listings. But I think those are the kinds of things that we could all come together on as being chemicals or being lists of chemicals that belong on this particular list as well. And those would obviously include the ones that we've talked about, and no need to go beyond that now, although as regulations were written, you know, we'd want to have a fair amount of specificity as to which lists are chosen and why, and why others might not be chosen. But then that gets us to the second question, which is how about hazard traits that for which authoritative bodies haven't created lists so far? And once you get beyond things for which, you know, we've arguably evaluated just on qualitative grounds, like something is or is not a carcinogen, then it gets to be hard because as most toxicologists will say, everything is toxic. It's just a matter of dose. And once we start getting into the other, hazard areas like neurotoxicity or organ toxicity or sensitization, you know, everything that we've talked about and that I agree is important, you know, then we get into this issue of, well, you know, how do we do that on a hazard basis when we know that everything will be an organ toxicant, for example, at some dosage. And that I think is a problem in that we either have to go back and make this a much more risk-based process, which I think is fine, but it's very labor-intensive, or we go with some sort of cutoffs, such as are in the GHS system and that are, I think, recapitulated in one of the things that got sent out in the handouts for design for the environment for EPA. But until we have those kinds of processes and how data are evaluated, I think it's really hard to start putting those other hazard traits into this system. You know, that this is where it becomes critical to have a process.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, George. Does it, by the way, George, does it tell you something, does it help you with wrestling with this one list, two list process thing that you were working on before?
Not necessarily. I'm still a little bit in the dark about that. You know, in that I think that anything that makes a list is going to have consequences, both intended and unintended. And so I would want to make sure that what got onto a list was something that would be, you know, fairly widely agreed really is a problematic chemical, not just something that, you know, we're putting in a parking lot just because it exists in commerce.
All right. Thank you. Anyone else?
Art.
Okay, Art. I think we'll take you, Art, and then we'll take a short break. How's that?
Sounds great. Thank you very much, Chair. Just a short follow-up on what George was saying about how to deal with hazard traits for which, you know, they have no authoritative body or, in fact, no mechanism of determining how hazardous it may be. You know, again, going back to the endpoint that Julia made about neurodevelopmental toxicity. Just a bit of information from our experience working on alternative assessments, such as using a green screen and also sitting on this advisory committee for green screen, is that, you know, it's a very labor-intensive process. So does it get to a situation where, in fact, then DTSC will be going through the process of ranking or evaluating how hazardous some of these chemicals are with, you know, an endpoint of interest, again, such as neurodevelopmental tox? Or by doing that, would that take away from, you know, DTSC's main focus of creating a process or generating a list based on, you know, input from the Green Ribbon Science Panel, rather than them, you know, going through and then basically kind of like doing a green screen or a DFE process and then evaluating the various chemicals that might have, you know, data or information to suggest that it might be a neurodevelopmental toxin. So just, again, just following up on the point that George made about how this may be fairly labor-intensive and that, in fact, we may not have a good standardized mechanism or method for doing, you know, such evaluations. Thank you.
Thank you, Art. Thank you. So we've been going a good couple of, well over an hour and a half here. It might be useful to take a short break, if I could suggest no more than 5 minutes. The committee will reconvene in about 5 minutes from now. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken.